Katung checked on the truck and then spied a likely-looking bit of nest fodder. It hurried down the trunk, head first after it. The sparrow took wing. The ant took what chocolate it could manage and headed for its hill. The chickadees began to sing more loudly. On the next block, a dog barked. The letters on the sides of the milk truck read, Kramer's Dairy. There was a picture of a bottle of milk, and below that, Morning Deliveries, Our Specialty. The milkman wore a blue-gray uniform and a cocked hat. Written over the pocket in gold thread was a name, Spike. He was whistling over the comfortable rattle of bottles in ice behind him. He pulled the truck into the curb at the McKenzie's house, took his milk case from the floor beside him, and swung out onto the sidewalk. He paused for a moment to sniff the air, fresh and new and infinitely mysterious, and then he strode strongly up the walk to the door. A small square of white paper was held to the mailbox by a magnet that looked like a tomato. Spike read what was written there closely and slowly, as one might read a message he had found in an old bottle crusted with salt. 1 quart milk, 1 Econ cream, 1 orange juice. Thanks, Nella M. Spike the milkman looked at his hand case thoughtfully, set it down, and from it produced the milk and cream. He inspected the sheet again, lifted the tomato magnet to make sure he had not missed a period, comma, or dash, which would change the complexion of things, nodded, replaced the magnet, picked up his case, and went back to the truck. The back of the milk truck was damp and black and cool. There was a sunken, buggy smell in its air. It mixed uneasily with the smell of dairy products. The orange juice was behind the deadly nightshade. He pulled a carton out of the ice, nodded again, and went back up the walk. He put the carton of juice down with the milk and cream and went back to his truck. Not too far away, the 5 o'clock whistle blew at the industrial laundry where Spike's old friend Rocky worked. He thought of Rocky starting up his laundry wheels in the steamy, gasping heat, and smiled. Perhaps he would see Rocky later. Perhaps tonight, when deliveries were done. Spike started the truck and drove on. A little transistor radio hung on an imitation leather strap from a blood-stained meat hook which curved down from the cab's ceiling. He turned it on, and quiet music counterpointed his engine as he drove up to the McCarthy house. Mrs. McCarthy's note was where it always was, wedged into the letter slot. It was brief and to the point. Chocolate. Spike took out his pen, scrawled Delivery Made across it, and pushed it through the letter slot. Then he went back to the truck. The chocolate milk was stacked in 2 coolers at the very back, handy to the rear doors because it was a very big cellar in June. The milkman glanced at the coolers, then reached over them and took one of the empty chocolate milk cartons he kept in the far corner. The carton was, of course, brown, and a happy youngster cavorted above printed matter, which informed the consumer that this was Kramer's Dairy Drink, wholesome and delicious, serve hot or cold, kids love it. He set the empty carton on top of a case of milk. Then he brushed aside ice chips until he could see the mayonnaise jar. He grabbed it and looked inside. The tarantula moved, but sluggishly. The cold had doped it. Spike unscrewed the lid of the jar and tipped it over the opened carton. The tarantula made a feeble effort to scramble back up the slick glass side of the jar and succeeded not at all. It fell into the empty chocolate milk carton with a fat plop. The milkman carefully reclosed the carton, put it in his carrier, and dashed up the McCarthy's walk. Spiders were his favorite, and spiders were his best, even if he did say so himself. A day when he could deliver a spider was a happy day for Spike. As he made his way slowly up Culver, the symphony of the dawn continued. The pearly band in the east gave way to a deepening flush of pink, first barely discernible, then rapidly brightening to a scarlet, which began almost immediately to fade towards summer blue. The first rays of sunlight, pretty as a drawing in a child's Sunday school workbook, now waited in the wings. At the Weber's house, Spike left a bottle of all-purpose cream, filled with an acid gel. At the Jenner's, he left 5 quarts of milk. Growing boys there. He had never seen them, but there was a treehouse out back, and sometimes there were bikes and ball bats left in the yard. At the Collins's, 2 quarts of milk and a carton of yogurt. At Miss Ordway's, a carton of eggnog that had been spiked with belladonna. Down the block, a door slammed. Mr. Weber, who had to go all the way into the city, opened the slatted carport door and went inside swinging his briefcase. The milkman waited for the waspy sound of his little sob starting up and smiled when he heard it.
"Variety is the spice of life,"
Spike's mother, God rest her soul, had been fond of saying.
"But we are Irish, and the Irish prefer to take their taters plain. Be regular in all ways, Spike, and you will be happy."
And it was just as true as could be, he had found as he rolled down the road of life in his neat beige milk truck. Only 3 houses left now. At the Kincaid's he found a note which read, "Nothing today, thanks," and left a capped milk bottle, which looked empty, but contained a deadly cyanide gas. At the Walker's, he left 2 quarts of milk and a pint of whipping cream. By the time he reached the Mertens at the end of the block, rays of sunlight were shining through the trees and dappling the faded hopscotch grid on the sidewalk which passed the Mertens' yard. Spike bent, picked up what looked like a pretty damn good hopscotching rock, flat on one side, and tossed it. The pebble landed on a line. He shook his head, grinned, and went up the walk whistling. The light breeze brought him the smell of industrial laundry soap, making him think again of Rocky. He was sure all the time that he would be seeing Rocky tonight. Here the note was pinned in the Mertens newspaper holder. "Cancel." Spike opened the door and went in. The house was crypt cold and without furniture. Barren it was, stripped to the walls. Even the stove in the kitchen was gone. There was a brighter square of linoleum where it had stood. In the living room, every scrap of wallpaper had been removed from the walls. The globe was gone from the overhead light. The bulb had been fused black. A huge splotch of drying blood covered part of one wall. It looked like a psychiatrist's ink blot. In the center of it, a crater had been gouged deeply into the plaster. There was a matted clump of hair in this crater, and a few splinters of bone. The milkman nodded, went back out, and stood on the porch for a moment. It would be a fine day. The sky was already bluer than a baby's eye, and patched with guileless little fair-weather clouds, the ones baseball players call angels. He pulled the note from the newspaper holder and crumpled it into a ball. He put it in the left front pocket of his white milkman's pants. He went back to his truck, kicking the stone from the hopscotch grid into the gutter. The milk truck rattled around the corner and was gone. The day brightened. A boy banged out of a house, grinned up at the sky, and brought in the milk.
Big Wheels, A Tale of the Laundry Game, Milkman Number 2, read by Dylan Baker.
Rocky and Leo, both drunk as the last lords of creation, cruised slowly down Culver Street and then out along Balfour Avenue toward Crescent. They were ensconced in Rocky's 1957 Chrysler. Between them, balanced with drunken care on the monstrous hump of the Chrysler's drive shaft, sat a case of Iron City beer. It was their second case of the evening. The evening had actually begun at 4 in the afternoon, which was punch-out time at the laundry. "Shit on a shingle," Rocky said, stopping at the red blinker light above the intersection of Balfour Avenue and Highway 99. He did not look for traffic in either direction, but did cast a sly glance behind them. A half-full can of IC, emblazoned with a colorful picture of Terry Bradshaw, rested against his crotch. He took a swig and then turned left on 99. The universal joint made a thick grunting sound as they started chuggingly off in second gear. The Chrysler had lost its first gear some 2 months ago.
"Give me a shingle and I'll shit on it," Leo said obligingly.
"What time is it?"
Leo held his watch up until it was almost touching the tip of his cigarette, and then puffed madly until he could get a reading.
"Almost 8.
"Shit on a shingle."
They passed a sign which read, "Pittsburgh 44.
"Nobody is going to inspect this here Detroit, honey," Leo said. "Nobody in his right mind, at least."
Rocky fetched third gear. The Universal moaned to itself, and the Chrysler began to have the automotive equivalent of a petit mal epileptic seizure. The spasm eventually passed, and the speedometer climbed tiredly to 40. It hung there precariously. When they reached the intersection of Highway 99 and Devon Stream Road — Devon Stream formed the border between the townships of Crescent and Devon for some 8 miles — Rocky turned onto the latter almost upon a whim, although perhaps even then some memory of old Stiff Socks had begun to stir deep down in what passed for Rocky's subconscious. He and Leo had been driving more or less at random since leaving work. It was the last day of June, and the inspection sticker on Rocky's Chrysler would become invalid at exactly 12:01 a.m. tomorrow, 4 hours from right now. Less than 4 hours from right now. Rocky found this eventuality almost too painful to contemplate, and Leo didn't care. It was not his car. Also, he had drunk enough Iron City beer to reach a state of deep cerebral paralysis. Devon Road wound through the only heavily wooded area of Crescent. Great bunches of elms and oaks crowded in on both sides, lush and alive and full of moving shadows as night began to close over southwestern Pennsylvania. The area was known, in fact, as the Devon Woods. It had attained capital letter status after the torture murder of a young girl and her boyfriend in 1968. The couple had been parking out here and were found in the boyfriend's 1959 Mercury. The Merc had real leather seats and a large chrome hood ornament. The occupants had been found in the back seat. Also in the front seat, the trunk, and the glove compartment. The killer had never been found.
Jug Humber better not stall out here, Rocky said. We're 90 miles from no place.
Bunk.
This interesting word had risen lately to the top 40 of Leo's vocabulary.
There's town, right over there.
Rocky sighed and sipped from his can of beer. The glow was not really town, but the kid was close enough to make argument worthless. It was the new shopping center. Those high-intensity arc sodium lights really threw a glare. While looking in that direction, Rocky drove the car over to the left side of the road, looped back, almost went into the right-hand ditch, and finally got back in his lane again.
Whoops, he said.
Leo burped and gurgled. They had been working together at the New Adams Laundry since September, when Leo had been hired as Rocky's washroom helper. Leo was a rodent-featured young man of 22 who looked as if he might have quite a lot of jail time in his future. He claimed he was saving $20 a week from his pay to buy a used Kawasaki motorcycle. He said he was going west on this bike when cold weather came. Leo had held a grand total of 12 jobs since he and the world of academics had parted company at the minimum age of 16. He liked the laundry fine. Rocky was teaching him the various wash cycles, and Leo believed he was finally learning a skill, which would come in handy when he reached Flagstaff. Rocky, an older hand, had been at New Adams for 14 years. His hands, ghost-like and bleached as he handled the steering wheel, proved it. He had done a 4-month bit for carrying a concealed weapon in 1970. His wife, then puffily pregnant with their third child, announced, one, that it was not his, Rocky's child, but the milkman's child, and two, that she wanted a divorce on grounds of mental cruelty. Two things about this situation had driven Rocky to carry a concealed weapon. One, he had been cuckolded. And two, he had been cuckolded by the, for Christ's sakes, milkman, a trout-eyed, long-haired piece of work named Spike Milligan. Spike drove for Kramer's Dairy. The milkman, for God's sweet sake, the milkman! And could you die? Could you just fucking flop down into the gutter and die? Even to Rocky, who had never progressed much beyond reading the Fleer's funnies that came wrapped around the bubblegum he chewed indefatigably at work, the situation had sonorous, classical overtones. As a result, he had duly informed his wife of two facts. One, no divorce. And two, he was going to let a large amount of daylight into Spike Milligan. He had purchased a .32-caliber pistol some 10 years ago, which he used occasionally to shoot at bottles, tin cans, and small dogs. He left his house on Oak Street that morning and headed for the dairy, hoping to catch Spike when he finished his morning deliveries. Rocky stopped at the Four Corners Tavern on the way to have a few beers. 6, 8, maybe 20, it was hard to remember. While he was drinking, his wife called the cops. They were waiting for him on the corner of Oak and Balfour. Rocky was searched, and one of the cops plucked the .32 from his waistband.
"I think you're going away for a while, my friend," the cop who found the gun told him.
And that was just what Rocky did. He spent the next 4 months washing sheets and pillowcases for the state of Pennsylvania. During this period, his wife got a Nevada divorce, and when Rocky got out of the slam, she was living with Spike Milligan in a Dakin Street apartment house with a pink flamingo on the front lawn. In addition to his two older children, Rocky still more or less assumed they were his, The couple were now possessed of an infant who was every bit as trout-eyed as his daddy. They were also possessed of $15 a week in alimony.
"Rocky, I think I'm getting carsick," Leo said. "Couldn't we just pull over and drink?"
"I gotta get a sticker on my wheels," Rocky said. "This is important. Man's no good without his wheels."
"Nobody in his right mind is gonna inspect this. I told you that. It ain't got no turn signals."
"They blink if I step on the brake at the same time. And anybody who don't step on his brakes when he's making a turn is looking to do a rollover."
"Window on this side's cracked?"
"I'll roll it down."
"What if the inspectionist asks you to roll it up so he can check it?"
"I'll burn that bridge when I come to it," Rocky said coolly.
He tossed his beer can out and got a refill. This new one had Franco Harris on it. Apparently, the Iron City Company was playing the Steelers' greatest hits this summer. He popped the top, beer splurted.
"Wish I had a woman," Leo said, looking into the dark. He smiled strangely.
"If you had a woman, you'd never get out west. What a woman does is keep a man from getting any further west. That's how they operate. That is their mission. Didn't you tell me you wanted to go out west?"
"Yeah, and I'm going, too."
"You'll never go," Rocky said. "Pretty soon, you'll have a woman. Next, you'll have abalone, alimony. You know, women always lead up to alimony. Cars are better. Stick to cars."
"Pretty hard to screw a car."
"You'd be surprised," Rocky said, and giggled.
The woods had begun to straggle away into new dwellings. Lights twinkled up on the left, and Rocky suddenly slammed on the brakes. The brake lights and turn signals both went on at once. It was a home wiring job. Leo lurched forward, spilling beer on the seat.
What?
"Look," Rocky said. "I think I know that fella."
There was a tumorous, ramshackle garage and Citgo filling station on the left side of the road. The sign in front said, "Bob's Gas and Service. Bob Driscoll, proprietor. Front end alignment our specialty.
Defend your God-given right to bear arms."
And at the very bottom, "State Inspection Station Number 72.
"Nobody in his right mind," Leo began again.
"It's Bobby Driscoll," Rocky cried. "Me and Bobby Driscoll went to school together. We got it knocked. Bitch your fur."
He pulled in unevenly, headlights illuminating the open door of the garage bay. He popped the clutch and roared toward it. A stoop-shouldered man in a green coverall ran out, making frantic stopping gestures.
"That's Bob!" Rocky yelled exultantly. "Hey! Stiff socks!"
They ran into the side of the garage. The Chrysler had another seizure, grand mal this time. A small yellow flame appeared at the end of the sagging tailpipe, followed by a puff of blue smoke. The car stalled gratefully. Leo lurched forward, spilling more beer. Rocky keyed the engine and backed off for another try. Bob Driscoll ran over, profanity spilling out of his mouth in colorful streamers. He was waving his arms.
"The hell you think you're doing, you goddamn son of Bobby!" Rocky yelled, his delight nearly orgasmic. "Hey, stiff socks! What you say, buddy?"
Bob peered in through Rocky's window. He had a twisted, tired face that was mostly hidden in the shadow thrown by the bill of his cap.
Who called me Stiff Socks?
Me! Rocky fairly screamed. It's me, you old finger diddler. It's your old buddy.
Who in the hell?
Johnny Rockwell. You gone blind as well as foolish?
Cautiously. Rocky?
Yeah, you son of a bitch.
Christ Jesus.
Slow, unwilling pleasure seeped across Bob's face.
I ain't seen you since, well, since the Catamounts game, anyway.
Shoot, want that some hot ticket?
Rocky slapped his thigh, sending up a gusher of Iron City. Leo burped.
Sure it was. Only time we ever won our class. Even then, we couldn't seem to win the championship. Say, you beat hell out of the side of my garage, Rocky. You...
Yeah, same old Stiff Socks, same old guy. You ain't changed, even a hair.
Rocky belatedly peeked as far under the visor of the baseball cap as he could see, hoping this was true. It appeared, however, that old Stiff Socks had gone either partially or completely bald.
Jesus, ain't it something, running into you like this?
Did you finally marry Marcy Drew?
Hell yeah, back in 70. Where were you?
Jail, most probably. Listen, Muffa, can you inspect this baby?
Caution again. You mean your car? Rocky cackled.
No, my old hog leg. Sure, my car.
Can you?
Bob opened his mouth to say no.
This here's an old friend of mine, Leo Edwards. Leo, won't you meet the only basketball player from Crescent High who didn't change his sweat socks for 4 years?
Pleased to meet you, Leo said,
doing his duty, just as his mother had instructed on one of the occasions when that lady was sober. Rocky cackled.
Want a beer, Stiffy?
Bob opened his mouth to say no.
Here's a little crab catcher,
Rocky exclaimed. He popped the top. The beer, crazied up by the headlong run into the side of Bob Driscoll's garage, boiled over the top and down Rocky's wrist. Rocky shoved it into Bob's hand. Bob sipped quickly to keep his own hand from being flooded.
Rocky, we close at...
Just a second. Let me back up. I got some crazy here.
Rocky dragged the gear shift lever up into reverse, popped the clutch, skinned a gas pump, and then drove the Chrysler jerkily inside. He was out in a minute, shaking Bob's free hand like a politician. Bob looked dazed. Leo sat in the car, tipping a fresh beer. He was also farting. A lot of beer always made him fart.
Hey,
Rocky said, staggering around a pile of rusty hubcaps.
You remember Diana Rocklehouse?
Sure do, Bob said.
An unwilling grin came to his mouth.
She was the one with the...
He cupped his hands in front of his chest. Rocky howled.
That's her! You got it, Muffa! She's still in town.
I think she moved to...
Figures, Rocky said. The ones who don't stay always move. You can put a sticker on this pig, can't you?
Well, my wife said she'd wait supper and we close at...
Jesus, it'd sure put a help on me if you could. I'd sure appreciate it. I could do some personal laundry for your wife. That's what I do. Wash. At New Adams.
And I am learning,
Leo said, and farted again.
Washer, Danies, whatever you want. What you say, Bobby?
Well, I suppose I could look her over.
Sure,
Rocky said, clapping Bob on the back and winking at Leo.
Same old stiff socks. What a guy.
Yeah, Bob said, sighing. He pulled on his beer, his oily fingers mostly obscuring Mean Joe Green's face. You beat hell out of your bumper, Rocky.
Give it some class. Goddamn car needs some class. But it's one big motherfucking set of wheels, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess.
Hey, want you to meet the guy I work with. Leo, this is the only basketball player from—
You introduced us already, Bob said with a soft, despairing smile.
Howdy doody, Leo said.
He fumbled for another can of Iron City. Silvery lines like railroad tracks glimpsed at high noon on a hot, clear day were beginning to trace their way across his field of vision.
Crescent High, who didn't change his—
Wanna show me your headlights, Rocky? Bob asked.
Sure, great lights. Halogen or nitrogen or some fucking gin. They got class. Pop those little crab catchers right the fuck on, Leo.
Leo turned on the windshield wipers. That's good, Bob said patiently. He took a big swallow of beer. Now how about the lights? Leo popped on the headlights. High beam. Leo tapped for the dimmer switch with his left foot. He was pretty sure it was down there someplace, and finally he happened upon it. The high beams threw Rocky and Bob into sharp relief, like exhibits in a police lineup.
Fucking nitrogen headlights, what'd I tell you? Rocky cried, and then cackled. Goddamn Bobby! Seeing you is better than getting a check in the mail.
How about the turn signals? Bob asked. Leo smiled vaguely at Bob and did nothing.
Better let me do it, Rocky said.
He bumped his head a good one as he got in behind the wheel.
The kid don't feel too good, I don't think.
He cramped down on the brake at the same time he flicked up the turn blinker. Okay, Bob said, but does it work without the brake?
Does it say anywhere in the motor vehicle inspection manual that it has to?
Rocky asked craftily. Bob sighed. His wife was waiting dinner. His wife had large floppy breasts and blonde hair that was black at the roots. His wife was partial to donuts by the dozen, a product sold at the local Giant Eagle store. When his wife came to the garage on Thursday nights for her bingo money, her hair was usually done up in large green rollers under a green chiffon scarf. This made her head look like a futuristic AM/FM radio. Once, near 3 in the morning, he had wakened and looked at her slack paper face in the soulless graveyard glare of the streetlight outside their bedroom window. He had thought how easy it could be. Just jackknife over on top of her. Just drive a knee into her gut so she would lose her air and be unable to scream. Just screw both hands around her neck. Then just put her in the tub and whack her into prime cuts, and mail her away someplace to Robert Driscoll, care of General Delivery. Any old place. Lima, Indiana, North Pole, New Hampshire, Intercourse, Pennsylvania, Kunkel, Iowa, any old place. It could be done. God knew it had been done in the past.
No, he told Rocky. I guess it doesn't say any place in the regs that they have to work on their own.
Exactly, in so many words. He upended the can and the rest of the beer gurgled down his throat. It was warm in the garage and he had had no supper. He could feel the beer rise immediately into his mind.
Hey, Stiff Socks just came up empty, Rocky said. Hand up a brew, Leo.
No, Rocky, I really... Leo, who was seeing none too well, finally happened on a can.
Want a wide receiver?
He asked, and passed the can to Rocky. Rocky handed it to Bob, whose demurrals petered out as he held the can's cold actuality in his hand. It bore the smiling face of Lynn Swan. He opened it. Leo farted homily to close the transaction. All of them drank from football player cans for a moment.
Horn work? Bob finally asked, breaking the silence apologetically.
Sure.
Rocky hit the ring with his elbow. It emitted a feeble squeak.
Battery's a little low, though.
They drank in silence.
That goddamn rat was as big as a cocker spaniel, Leo exclaimed.
Kid's carrying quite a load, Rocky explained.
Bob thought about it.
Yeah,
he said. This struck Rocky's funny bone, and he cackled through a mouthful of beer. A little trickled out of his nose, and this made Bob laugh. It did Rocky good to hear him, because Bob had looked like one sad sack when they had rolled in. They drank in silence a while more.
Diana Rocklehouse, Bob said meditatively.
Rocky sniggered. Bob chuckled and held his hands out in front of his chest. Rocky laughed and held his own out even further. Bob guffawed.
You remember that picture of Ursula Andress that Tinker Johnson pasted on old Lady Fremantle's bulletin board?
Rocky howled.
Any drawed on those two big old jahoobies?
And she just about had a heart attack.
You two can laugh,
Leo said morosely and farted. Bob blinked at him.
Huh?
Laugh, Leo said. I said, you two can laugh. Neither of you has got a hole in your back.
Don't listen to him,
Rocky said, a trifle uneasily.
Kid's got a skinful.
You got a hole in your back? Bob asked Leo.
The laundry,
Leo said, smiling.
We got these big washers, see? Only we call 'em wheels. They're laundry wheels. That's why we call 'em wheels. I load 'em, I pull 'em, I load 'em again. Put the shit in dirty, take the shit out clean. That's what I do. And I do it with class.
He looked at Bob with insane confidence.
Got a hole in my back from doing it, though.
Yeah?
Bob was looking at Leo with fascination. Rocky shifted uneasily.
There's a hole in the roof, Leo said. Right over the third wheel. They're round, see? So we call them wheels. When it rains, the water comes down, drop, drop, drop. Each drop hits me, whap, in the back. Now I got a hole there, like this.
He made a shallow curve with one hand.
Wanna see?
He don't wanna see any such deformity, Rocky shouted. We're talking about old times here, and there ain't no effing hole in your back anyway.
I wanna see it, Bob said.
They're round, so we call it the laundry, Leo said.
Rocky smiled and clapped Leo on the shoulder.
No more of this talk. You could be walking home, my good little buddy. Now, why don't you hand me up my namesake if there's one left?
Leo peered down into the carton of beer, and after a while, he handed up a can with Rocky Blyer on it.
"'At a way to go,' Rocky said, cheerful again.
The entire case was gone an hour later, and Rocky sent Leo stumbling up the road to Pauline's superette for more. Leo's eyes were ferret red by this time, and his shirt had come untucked. He was trying, with myopic concentration, to get his camels out of his rolled-up shirt sleeve. Bob was in the bathroom, urinating and singing the school song.
"Don't wanna walk up there," Leo muttered.
"Yeah, but you're too fucking drunk to drive."
Leo walked in a drunken semicircle, still trying to coax his cigarettes out of his shirt sleeve.
"It's dark and cold."
"You want to get a sticker on that car or not?"
Rocky hissed at him. He had begun to see weird things at the edges of his vision. The most persistent was a huge bug wrapped in spider silk in the far corner. Leo looked at him with his scarlet eyes.
"Ain't my car,"
he said with bogus cunning.
"And you'll never ride in it again, neither, if you don't go and get that beer," Rocky said.
He glanced fearfully at the dead bug in the corner.
"You just try me and see if I'm kidding."
"Okay," Leo whined. "Okay, you don't have to get pissy about it."
He walked off the road twice on his way up to the corner and once on the way back. When he finally achieved the warmth and light of the garage again, both of them were singing the school song. Bob had managed, by hook or by crook, to get the Chrysler up on the lift. He was wandering around underneath it, peering at the rusty exhaust system.
"There's some holes in your straight pipe," he said.
"Ain't no straight pipes under there," Rocky said.
They both found this spit-sprayingly funny.
"Beer's here,"
Leo announced, put the case down, sat on a wheel rim, and fell immediately into a half-doze. He had swallowed three himself on the way back to lighten the load. Rocky handed Bob a beer and held one himself.
"Race? Just like old times?"
"Sure," Bob said. He smiled tightly. In his mind's eye, he could see himself in the cockpit of a low-to-the-ground, streamlined Formula One racer, one hand resting cockily on the wheel as he waited for the drop of the flag, the other touching his lucky piece, the hood ornament from a 59 Mercury. He had forgotten Rocky's straight pipe and his blousy wife with her transistorized hair curlers. They opened their beers and chugged them. It was a dead heat. Both dropped their cans to the cracked concrete and raised their middle fingers at the same time. Their belches echoed off the walls like rifle shots.
"Just like old times," Bob said, sounding forlorn. "Nothing's just like old times, Rocky."
"I know it," Rocky agreed.
He struggled for a deep, luminous thought and found it.
"We're getting older by the day, Stiffy."
Bob sighed and belched again. Leo farted in the corner and began to hum "Get Off My Cloud."
"Try again?"
Rocky asked, handing Bob another beer.
"Might as well," Bob said. "Might just as well, Rocky, my boy."
The case Leo had brought back was gone by midnight, and the new inspection was affixed on the left side of Rocky's windshield at a slightly crazy angle. Rocky had made out the pertinent information himself before slapping the sticker on, working carefully to copy over the numbers from the tattered and greasy registration he had finally found in the glove compartment. He had to work carefully, because he was seeing triple. Bob sat cross-legged on the floor like a yoga master, a half-empty can of IC in front of him. He was staring fixedly at nothing.
"Well, you sure saved my life, Bob," Rocky said.
He kicked Leo in the ribs to wake him up. Leo grunted and woofed. His lids flickered briefly, closed, then flew open wide when Rocky footed him again.
"We home yet, Rocky? We..."
"You just shake her easy, Bobby," Rocky cried cheerfully.
He hooked his fingers into Leo's armpit and yanked. Leo came to his feet, screaming. Rocky half-carried him around the Chrysler and shoved him into the passenger seat.
"We'll stop back and do her again sometime."
"Those were the days," Bob said.
He had grown wet-eyed.
"Since then, everything just gets worse and worse, you know it?"
"I know it," Rocky said. "Everything has been refitted and be-shitted, but you just keep your thumb on it and don't do anything I wouldn't do."
"My wife ain't laid me in a year and a half," Bob said,
but the words were blanketed by the coughing misfire of Rocky's engine. Bob got to his feet and watched the Chrysler back out of the bay, taking a little wood from the left side of the door. Leo hung out the window, smiling like an idiot saint.
"Come by the laundry sometime, Skinner. I'll show you the hole in my back. I'll show you my wheels. I'll show you..."
Rocky's arm suddenly shot out like a vaudeville hook and pulled him into the dimness.
"Bye, fella,"
Rocky yelled. The Chrysler did a drunken slalom around the three gas pump islands and bucketed off into the night. Bob watched until the taillights were only flicker flies and then walked carefully back inside the garage. On his cluttered workbench was a chrome ornament from some old car. He began to play with it, and soon he was crying cheap tears for the old days. Later, sometime after 3 in the morning, he strangled his wife and then burned down the house to make it look like an accident.
"Jesus," Rocky said to Leo as Bob's garage shrank to a point of white light behind them. "How about that, old Stiffy?"
Rocky had reached that stage of drunkenness where every part of himself seemed gone, except for a tiny, glowing coal of sobriety somewhere deep in the middle of his mind. Leo did not reply. In the pale green light thrown by the dashboard instruments, he looked like the Dormouse at Alice's tea party.
"He was really bombarded," Rocky went on.
He drove on the left side of the road for a while, and then the Chrysler wandered back.
"Good thing for you he probably won't remember what you told him. Another time it could be different. How many times do I have to tell you? You gotta shut up about this idea that you got a fucking hole in your back."
"You know I got a hole in my back."
"Well, so what?"
"It's my hole, that's so what. And I'll talk about my hole whenever I..."
He looked around suddenly.
"Truck behind us just pulled out of that side road. No lights."
Rocky looked up into the rearview mirror. Yes, the truck was there, and its shape was distinctive. It was a milk truck. He didn't have to read Kramer's Dairy on the side to know whose it was, either.
"It's Spike," Rocky said fearfully. "It's Spike Milligan. Jesus, I thought he only made morning deliveries."
"Who?"
Rocky didn't answer. A tight, drunk grin spread over his lower face. It did not touch his eyes, which were now huge and red like spirit lamps. He suddenly floored the Chrysler, which belched blue oil smoke and reluctantly creaked its way up to 60.
"Hey, you're too drunk to go this fast.
You're..." Leo paused vaguely, seeming to lose track of his message. The trees and houses raced by them, vague blurs in the graveyard of 1215. They blew by a stop sign and flew over a large bump, leaving the road for a moment afterwards. When they came down, the low-hung muffler struck a spark on the asphalt. In the back, cans clinked and rattled. The faces of Pittsburgh Steeler players rolled back and forth, sometimes in the light, sometimes in shadow.
"I was fooling," Leo said wildly. "There ain't no truck."
"It's him, and he kills people," Rocky screamed. "I seen his bug back in the garage. God damn!"
They roared up Southern Hill on the wrong side of the road. A station wagon coming in the other direction skidded crazily over the gravel shoulder and down into the ditch, getting out of their way. Leo looked behind him. The road was empty.
"Rocky,
come and get me, Spike!"
Rocky screamed.
"You just come on and get me!"
The Chrysler had reached 80, a speed which Rocky, in a more sober frame of mind, would not have believed possible. They came around the turn which leads onto the Johnson Flat Road, smoke spurting up from Rocky's bald tires. The Chrysler screamed into the night like a ghost, lights searching the empty road ahead. Suddenly, a 1959 Mercury roared at them out of the dark, straddling the center line. Rocky screamed and threw his hands up in front of his face. Leo had just time to see the Mercury was missing its hood ornament before the crash came. Half a mile behind, lights flickered on at a side crossing, and a milk truck with Kramer's Dairy written on the side pulled out and began to move toward the pillar of flame and the twisted, blackening hulks in the center of the road. It moved at a sedate speed. The transistor dangling by its strap from the meat hook played rhythm and blues. "That's it," Spike said. "Now we're going over to Bob Driscoll's house. He thinks he's got gasoline out in his garage, but I'm not sure he does." "This has been one very long day. Wouldn't you agree?" But when he turned around, the back of the truck was empty. Even the bug was gone.
Grandma. Read by Francis Sternhagen.
George's mother went to the door, hesitated there, came back and tousled George's hair. "I don't want you to worry," she said. "You'll be all right. Grandma, too." "Sure, I'll be okay. Tell Buddy to lay chilly." "Pardon me?" George smiled. "To stay cool." "Oh, very funny." She smiled back at him, a distracted, going in six directions at once smile. "George, are you sure?" "I'll be fine." "Are you sure what? Are you sure you're not scared to be alone with Grandma?" Was that what she was going to ask? If it was, the answer is no. After all, it wasn't like he was six anymore, when they had first come here to Maine to take care of Grandma, and he had cried with terror whenever Grandma held out her heavy arms toward him. From her white vinyl chair that always smelled of the poached eggs she ate, and the sweet, bland powder George's mom rubbed into her flabby, wrinkled skin, she held out her white elephant arms, wanting him to come to her and be hugged to that huge and heavy old white elephant body. Buddy had gone to her, had been enfolded in Grandma's blind embrace, and Buddy had come out alive, but Buddy was 2 years older. Now Buddy had broken his leg and was at the CMG hospital in Lewiston. "You've got the doctor's number if something should go wrong, which it won't, right?" "Sure," he said, and swallowed something dry in his throat. He smiled. Did the smile look okay? Sure, sure it did. He wasn't scared of Grandma anymore. After all, he wasn't six anymore. Mom was going up to the hospital to see Buddy, and he was just going to stay here and lay chilly. Hang out with Grandma a while. No problem. Mom went to the door again, hesitated again, and came back again, smiling that distracted going six ways at once smile. "If she wakes up and calls for her tea..." "I know," George said, seeing how scared and worried she was underneath that distracted smile. She was worried about Buddy. Buddy and his dumb pony league. The coach had called and said Buddy had been hurt in a play at the plate, and the first George had known of it, he was just home from school and sitting at the table eating some cookies and having a glass of Nestle's Quick, was when his mother gave a funny little gasp and said, "Hurt? Buddy? How bad?" "I know all that stuff, Mom. I got it knocked. Negative perspiration. Go on now." "You're a good boy, George. Don't be scared. You're not scared of Grandma anymore, are you?" "Uh-uh," George said. He smiled. The smile felt pretty good. The smile of a fellow who was laying chilly with negative perspiration on his brow. The smile of a fellow who had it knocked. The smile of a fellow who was most definitely not six anymore. He swallowed. It was a great smile. But beyond it, down in the darkness behind his smile, was one very dry throat. It felt as if his throat was lined with mitten wool. "Tell Buddy I'm sorry he broke his leg." "I will," she said, and went to the door again. 4 o'clock sunshine slanted in through the window. "Thank God we took the sports insurance, Georgie. I don't know what we'd do if we didn't have it." "Tell him I hope he tagged the sucker out." She smiled her distracted smile, a woman of just past 50 with 2 late sons, 1 13, 1 11, and no man. This time she opened the door, and a cool whisper of October came in through the sheds. "And remember, Dr. Arlander..." "Sure," he said. "You better go, or his leg'll be fixed by the time you get there." "She'll probably sleep the whole time," Mom said. "I love you, Georgie. You're a good son." She closed the door on that. George went to the window and watched her hurry to the old 69 Dodge that burned too much gas and oil, digging the keys from her purse. Now that she was out of the house and didn't know George was looking at her, the distracted smile fell away and she only looked distracted. Distracted and sick with worry about Buddy. George felt bad for her. He didn't waste any similar feelings on Buddy, who liked to get him down and sit on top of him with a knee on each of George's shoulders and tap a spoon in the middle of George's forehead until he just about went crazy. Buddy called it the spoon torture of the heathen Chinee, and laughed like a madman, and sometimes went on doing it until George cried. Buddy, who sometimes gave him the Indian rope burn so hard that little drops of blood would appear on George's forearm, sitting on top of the pores like dew on blades of grass at dawn. Buddy, who had listened so sympathetically when George had one night whispered in the dark of their bedroom that he liked Heather McCardle, and who the next morning ran across the schoolyard screaming, "George and Heather, up in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G, first comes love, and then comes marriage, here comes Heather with a baby carriage," like a runaway fire engine. Broken legs did not keep older brothers like Buddy down for long, but George was rather looking forward to the quiet as long as this one did. "Let's see you give me the spoon torture of the heathen Chinee with your leg in a cast, buddy. Sure.